This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Vandana Dake may not be a name you've heard of, but if you've driven through Durham in the past decade, you have seen her work. Vandana is principal architect at Alliance Architecture. She helped transform the American Tobacco campus, where I'm sitting right now, as well as renovating buildings that became Motor Co., M Sushi, and The Pit. But Vandana's life began far from the Triangle. She was only one of five girls in her class at the architecture school she attended in India, where she had to fight the sexism of classmates and the cultural pressure from her grandparents to just get married and start a family. Vandana Dake is here to share her story and travels and talk about the day she decided to climb Mount Kilimanjaro, but we'll get to that later. Vandana, welcome back to the State of Things.
Namaste, Frank. How are you doing?
Namaste. Well, I said Vandana Dake may not be a name you've heard of, and of course you also say Dake, so that may be the reason you haven't heard the name, is because you say Dake.
It doesn't matter. Name is it's just a name.
It's good to have you here. Take us back to, I want to talk about certainly the development here and what's going on in the Triangle. In terms of architecture, but take us back to India, where you grew up and your family life.
So I was born in 1961, and I was born in Delhi. And but just to go a few steps backwards, my mom was 13 years old when she got married, and the first time she met my dad was at the day of the wedding. And it was very, very interesting. Good for me that I was born like 5 years later. But mom never got to go back to school and study. So I think it was very important when I was born that both my parents, and dad was actually a mechanical engineer. So it was very important for both of them to make sure that I got a good education. And that's where my education journey started.
And we should point out that that was not unusual for them at that time. This was an arranged marriage and very much a part of a cultural expectation that they were born into and that you were born into.
Absolutely.
Right? So talk about that, because then you also have a sister, so two girls in the family, right?
Growing up. My sister is born 5 years later than after me, and the whole family, including my grandparents, are very, very, very disappointed because no boy in the family to continue the name. And it was very interesting because, you know, there was expectation for many years. Mom went in a complete shell shock kind of a situation, what to do. And then my grandmother, offered my cousin brother to get adopted. And I think my mom, though she was not very educated, she was like, there's no way. We are happy with the two girls and we'll work with them. And that's it. You know, we both were raised as human beings, not boys and girls. And that to me is very, very important.
And very interesting. I mean, again, you get the idea of the cultural saturation here that is to say both parents were born into, both parents certainly conformed. And yet there was some resistance, it seems to me, particularly, let's say, when you decide you want to go into architecture school. Talk about that and that decision and how your family took that.
So, oh my God, going to architecture college was a whole different story. So I finished my high school, and the pressure starts from my grandparents, my uncles and aunts and neighbors about getting married. I'm 18 years old, and there is no way. I mean, marriage is not even, I'm not even thinking about it, and I've never dated a guy. You know, this is India. So, but I really want, I'm very good at studies. I'm very good at math, and I'm a very good artist. So dad came up with this idea, hey, why don't you join architecture college? Actually, I was so impressed that dad came up with this idea. And the reason he's coming with this idea is when he was studying after his graduation, he went to Germany. So he went to, you know, Western world very early on, and he kind of saw, you know, the equality between men and women. And he wanted his daughter to have a good life. So he put us in good college. So then I went to architecture college.
How was it there? Because I'm guessing, as I say, I think you were one of only five young women
there. It was awful. Yeah. It was awful. There were like 50 students out of the, there were five girls, and we were really bullied. And we were like, you know, nobody liked us because it was like taking away a seat from a boy. And, you know, people taunted us that, hey, you're going to get married anyway. Why are you wasting a seat? And they would not speak to us in, you know, I only spoke Hindi and English at that point, and I did not speak the local language. So they would call me nickname like Cake, you know, Marie Antoinette Cake, like you're having cake. So it was very, very difficult. But I didn't know anything better, and I had no choice, and I didn't think, and I knew that I had to stand on my feet and be successful and be dependent. So I just persisted.
You were actually interested in art, but your father thought, well, look, it's going to be pretty hard for you to make a living at that, right?
That's true. So Dad said, you know, you don't want to be an artist because, you know, artists are poor. They never make money. But here there was a new architecture college starting where you could work from home and have your own business practice and, you know, design things. And it also was a very good mix of, you know, art and science and math, and that's why he encouraged me to become an architect.
It's so interesting to think about that, because if you really thought, look, you know, you're, let's say you're your parents and you're trying to, you know, sort of patronize this young lady. She wants to be on her own. She doesn't want to get married. Well, I know, we'll just let her be an artist for a little while. Then, of course, she'll have to get married. And then, but no, he really is looking after you and hoping that you can be independent.
And I think that's him, but I think it's more mom, because mom realized, you know, getting married at such an early age and not being able to earn money, not being able to be financially independent, what that did to her. I mean, they're both married still. They're 60 years of marriage, but not because of choice, maybe sometimes, because there's no other choice, you know. So right. I think mom was the one who really encouraged that I became financially independent.
And was that what you, was it you who noticed or your mom who noticed how women had to kind of, you know, be subversive in getting money because they had no, they didn't
I noticed in. That. So I would go for summer vacation to Delhi, where my mom's family is, and I would see, though the family was very wealthy, every morning, Frank, my aunts would ask my uncles for spending money for that day. And it would be awful for me to ask, you know, that groveling that, and it's not that they didn't have the money, but it's just the power that my uncles had over my aunts. And I had decided very early on when I was 19, 20, that there is no way I could live that life. Yeah. I had to have my own money.
And it's one thing to sort of be clever about how to maintain the family and sort of, you know, be the managing, be the purchasing manager for the family and still be able to squirrel away a couple of dollars.
Yep.
But that's maybe not how you wanted to use your wisdom. So talk about this, because you were interested in art, but now you're having to take the, you know, the math and science along with it. What kind of a student were you and how interesting was it for you?
So I was a very, very good student, actually. I was almost like studious and a geek almost. And I did not, you know, growing up in India, girls did not really participate in sports at that point. We did not do a lot of music either. So it was mostly studies and, you know, come back and do homework. What was really interesting is my mom had no idea, no clue about architecture. After 2 years, she's telling me, well, all I see you is just drawing. When are you going to study? And that was just so interesting and so innocent, you know, that she really didn't know that. And I started starting internship from the second year. So it used to be long days, very hard work, 7 to 3 o'clock, you know, college, and then going back to work and then spending the whole night doing your, you know, classwork. So
what was your plan? Were you planning to stay in India and do that kind of work?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was no plan to step out. I mean, we did not, that time, girls did not go outside. I didn't even get a chance to go outside to another city to go to a better college, because that's not what we did. I mean, being allowed to study in architecture college itself was huge. My grandparents were so mad. They were so upset, you know, that, you know, I mean, every day I would hear that I'm like squandering away my chances of getting a husband. So. Mm. Yeah.
So there you are. You're in architecture school, imagining that you're going to stay there. Eventually, you finished and you went to Dubai, right?
Correct.
Talk about that decision and what you did there.
So I've just finished architecture college, and I was getting a lot of pressure to get married, and there was this guy in my class. He was. We both were competing for the first and second class, you know, in the class. So we both were very good students. And somehow we started talking. This is the last year of college. He didn't speak a word of English, and he didn't speak a word of my native language, Hindi. And I didn't speak a word of his language. So it was interesting how we were communicating. So obviously you can see the communication was not very good. But anyway, so we decided to get married, which was just, it was catastrophic from both our parents' sides. We had 1,500 guests for the wedding. and everybody
That's
thought,
a small wedding.
Yeah, it was a small wedding, and everybody thought it was a crazy idea, which I think it was a crazy idea now. But anyway, we get married, and we start working in India for a couple of years. But it was just not going well, you know, so we were thinking that maybe it's the parents, maybe it's the peer pressure, whatever. So we got an opportunity to work in Dubai. So we said, well, maybe let's try it out in Dubai. So we both go to Dubai, and that's where you start working. And I was there for 10 years.
What kind of work were you doing?
So we were working as architects, and they didn't really understand architecture a lot at that time. So we were designers. And it was like, you know, the family I was working with, so they are like these royal families. And the family I was working with had all sorts of businesses, so like car dealership. And I was there test driver, as a woman test driver, you know, testing, driving GMC, Fiats, and all sorts of. And then, you know, there were lots of different landscape architect and, you know, designing houses for the master and lots of, lots of.
Vanda Nadeke, principal architect at Alliance Architecture, now on the Triangle. Just ahead, we'll talk about what she did when she left Dubai, how she came to the Triangle, and what has happened since. We'll talk about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. These days, the American Tobacco Campus in downtown Durham is a busy place, buzzing with businesses and people. But it was not always the case. My guest today is one of the minds behind the revitalization of downtown Durham and has watched this area change. Vanda Nadeke is an architect at Alliance Architecture, but her story started in India. We got you to Dubai with your husband. So talk about, because you said you realized even in India that things were not working out, but thought perhaps getting away from some of the cultural difficulties you were having, family difficulties, things would work out, but they didn't.
So they didn't work out, and it took me 10 years to realize that it's not going to work out. And of course, you know, in this 10 years, his parents, my parents, are all trying all sorts of things, black magic, voodoo dolls, you know, all going to philosophers and all temples.
Astrology had to have
astrology,
something.
Astrology, yeah, horoscopes, everything, you know. And it was just, you know, it was not his fault or my fault. Yeah. It was just not to be. And what was really amazing, Frank, is Dad comes back from Spain. He's been traveling to Spain a lot during those days. And I remember he comes back to Dubai once as a stopover, and we are both sitting in this fountain, on the fountain, and he says, it's okay. You have to just let it go if you're not happy. Once he said that, it was almost like I was so relieved, and I didn't realize that I was just clinging on to the marriage, you know, to get an approval from my parents because I had gone against their wishes. And once that happened, it was awesome. You know, my ex-husband went back to India, and I continued. It was hard for my parents because they did not know how to disclose of the divorce in the Indian society. So it was convenient for me to live in Dubai for a while. And so I continued, and I was there for 10 years.
What was it like living there, culturally, personally for you, socially? What was it like to be in Dubai?
So it was very interesting. I think what was really good for me was being an educated woman, being a professional, really got me in the strata of the society. But if you're like in a working class mode, it's not easy. And plus, you know, because of English and good education, it helped you a lot in the, you know, society. But also it was very different in a way because you had a lot of workers coming from all over the world, especially Middle East and India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, where they would just come single and live in labor camps. And they would be allowed to go back and visit their families like after a year, 2 years, 3 years. So, you know, crime rate was higher. It's also a very strict Muslim community, you know, society. So, you know, you have to observe their rules. And
well, I wondered about that because you said you were test driving cars. And I even wondered about that.
So my ex-boss, who was like an Arab, he had actually studied in Virginia Tech. And so he had this American influence. His favorite, you know, artist was Prince. So, he did it crazy things. So they, and you know, none of the local people would test drive. Women test drive the cars.
Yeah.
So they, it was awesome. you can see how adventurous I was.
And you talked about the expat community from all over the world. Was there a fairly large Indian community? And were you part of that? Or did you find yourself trying to mix and get outside of it?
What no, it I definitely got outside of it. There was a part of Indian. There was a lot of Americans, you know, and during the Kuwait War, there was a lot of soldiers and the Gulf War was there. So, yeah, there was a lot of many communities, actually. Yeah.
Did you imagine that you would stay there? Did you imagine yourself having to travel and get out? What was going through your mind after the
divorce? I was very comfortable there. You know, we were paid. There was no sales tax. There was no income tax. We were paid very, very well. It was crazy. It was very, it's very hard life. That's why they pay you very well, right? That's how you they entice people to stay there. So I had no desire to move. And plus, you could travel to other parts of the country very easily, you know, around the country very easily. But then, you know, once I came on a vacation to California, visiting some friends in La Jolla, and that was my first step into United States.
Were you thinking about, talk about then the whole transition and how it is that you came to work here.
So friends kind of pushed me. This is now I'm single. My ex-husband has gone back. So, you know, friends in the United States were like, hey, come and visit us now. So I remember applying, going to the visa office in Dubai. I went there 3 a.m. for a 10 a.m. appointment. And there were 2,000, 3,000 people before me because Dubai was the only place in that region to have a visa office. So people from Iraq, Iran, everybody, it was unbelievable. And, you know, so I go in for my interview and, you know, the officer was asking me questions and are you going to stay there? I said, no, why would I want to stay there? You know, they pay me so well here. But anyway, I got a 10-year stamp visa and that was like a lottery. That was like $1 million. That means you can come in and out of U.S. for 10 years without any, you know, without any issues. So I visited U.S. And when I was here, one of my friends in Dubai, he posted my resume on the AIA website. And I started getting these calls from all these different architectural groups. And I had no idea. So I was not even carrying my portfolio. So I went to New York, Brooklyn. This is before, this is pre-Giuliani days. So it was like awful, you know, full of crime. I went to D.C., Denver. And then finally, John Warasula, my husband, he called me up and he invited me to for an interview to Durham. And he came and picked me up at the airport. The drive from RDU Airport to Durham, the office was in on 15501, was so amazing. It's the green trees around. You guys have no idea. Coming from Dubai, where there were hardly any trees, that was like, oh my God, this is Jannah. This is beautiful.
Yeah, but you got an offer or at least a call from Colorado, in Colorado.
Yeah, so I got a call from Colorado, Denver. And in fact, I visited and then they gave me ski passes. And, you know, that would be their mode of transport. And I said, there is no way at 30, 35, whatever, I'm not going to learn skiing. So there's no way. So, yeah.
Yeah, you don't want to have to ski to work either, I suppose.
Yeah.
So you actually, did you decide right then and there? At this point, you're really seriously considering coming to the United States, obviously, because you're taking these interviews.
I'm not still considering. So this was like it started as a big joke, right? I get this 10-year visa. I can come in and out of the country easily. Now I'm getting these job offers, which is awesome. And I'm turning down these job offers. I never really thought that I would leave. You know, it's so crazy. I want to go back a few seconds, Frank. So growing up in India, this is in the 70s and 80s when I'm in college and, architecture college and school. We were all so pro-Russia, you know, and our gurus and our, you know, mentors and the people we looked up on was Yasser Arafat, Fidel Castro, people who were trying to fight against, you know, capitalism and all that stuff. So U.S. was never in my radar. A lot of my friends came to study there, but I was like, never, I'm not going there. But it's amazing. Destiny is strange.
So you and I would say India lost that battle over. They have now gone fully capitalist.
Yep.
That argument appears to be over, at least for the moment. But there's still hope. Talk about your decision then. You said it was all kind of a lark, fun to go on these interviews, not really considering it. When did it turn for you? When did you decide to take it seriously?
So I think it was the drive to Raleigh, to the 15501 office. It was John's persistence.
This is Alliance Architecture.
Alliance Architecture. Yeah. John offered me a position, and it was friends and family and everybody like, are you crazy? You're getting a job offer. You've got why are you not taking it? And then I went back to my boss in Dubai. And when I told him about it, he was like really upset. And he said, no, I'm going to double your salary. I said, no, that's done. I'm going, it's time to move on. So that's how, I went back home to Delhi, packed my bag. And after 2 months, I was here with two suitcases.
What about the work itself? What did Alliance, was there anything about what Alliance was doing that appealed to you as well?
So they were doing a lot of work similar to what I was doing, that is interior architecture and changing, transforming places. And that's what I was doing in Dubai too. We would be working in remote Emirates like Sharjah and converting an old abandoned building into a new Maserati car dealership, things like that. So that was really appealing to me. The scale seemed small to me too. It was manageable, where you were making, impacting a human's life, by making those changes inside the space. So it's mostly interior architecture, right, which was really interesting.
And so what year is this now?
This is in 1999 it's going to be 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Right. But everything, this whole region is really at that moment on the threshold of change, right?
Correct.
Certainly the economy is changing. Tobacco has pretty much collapsed by then. We've started to lose the furniture industry, textiles, all of those legacy industries have collapsed. There's about to be a renaissance, but it hasn't quite happened yet. And that's the moment you arrive. And there's also a personal connection between you and John at a certain point. Tell us about that.
So that's really interesting, because when I left Dubai, the renaissance had not started in Dubai either. Mm. And then I arrive here and... initially, I'm working, and we were five of us at Alliance Architecture. And it was really interesting that John started Alliance in Durham, and he had two children. He has two children, actually, and the marriage was not doing too well. And after a couple of years, we both got connected personally. But what was really nice is and going back to my childhood, when I wanted to be independent, when I wanted to be able to express myself, and I wanted to have the freedom, that's exactly, I got from John, the freedom to design, the freedom to be whoever you want to be. It was perfect. I tell my dad that, I can only have one man in my life, Indian man in my life, and that's my dad. I just can't take any more. So it's just the way they, is thinking. So, and then at the same time, Durham started changing. Yeah. And, our office was on Holland Street Mall above Contech. I don't know if you guys know Contech. It's right next to the Marriott.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Now
yeah,
right
yeah.
behind the Durham Hotel.
Downtown, yeah.
Yeah, right downtown. And there was not a soul on the street at that point.
Yeah. It was like a movie lot back in those days. Everything, the buildings looked in pretty good shape, mostly, especially along Main Street. But they were dead
all
empty.
Boarded
it was
up.
Like a movie
yeah,
set.
It was all boarded up.
And so that's when you're here. Now, here's the thing. You're going to try to make a business in a place called Durham in the early 2000s when nobody wants to move to Durham and everybody would tell you that place doesn't have a chance. And the downtown, as they say, is kind of like a movie lot. What was John thinking? What were you looking at in terms of redevelopment or design from the business side of it?
So I don't think it was a very big, a well thought out plan. I think John wanted to be in Durham because of what he had seen in Baltimore, and he had missed out on the development in Baltimore. And when he saw Durham, that there was so much potential, it was and then when I saw Durham, it's like, oh my God, it's like blank canvas. There's so much that can happen here. So much can be done here. So it was like one building at a time, one storefront at a time. We moved our office from, from Holland Street Mall to Rigsby Avenue. And at that point, we were thinking, that maybe we'll rent upstairs, we'll rent downstairs to an IT company, the Economy Tank 2002. So we moved our office there. Then we bought the building Rue Claire is in. We developed Rue Claire. And that was really nice because it became a restaurant where people would drive into. It was a destination place. So that little building got developed, and then it was like one building at a time. So,
what was the community like at that time, the business community? I mean, you have to design for a client. The client has to have some faith that somebody's going to drive to a French restaurant in Durham. This doesn't sound crazy now, but man, was it out of whack at that time.
So
who were these people? Who were these first people? We'll talk about some of the other buildings that you worked on. Who were they?
So you're so right, Chris. So, Frank, so Rue Claire was Chris and John. I don't know if you remember them. They were from Pops, and the pizza place.
Mm-hmm.
So they started, they were already successful.
Yeah.
And they started Rue Claire. And initially it was like, where do I park? Is it safe to go in?
Right.
And, they would have people to escort from the parking deck to the restaurant. And then it was just one couple at a time.
So talk about that whole Rigsby, because that was known as the razor wire district down there where Motorco is now and all these. That was it. These all machine shops and car, repair shops with, razor wire around their storage areas. And that became the place where really Durham's nightlife began to grow.
Absolutely. So actually once American Tobacco got done, and it established, a clientele, it established people coming to Durham for a reason, the ballpark and the American Tobacco campus itself. The central district, I'm calling like the Rigsby Avenue kind of a thing, was a little stable. The next focus was on North Durham, which was the American Motorco and the Pit.
Well, start here, because the first, I think one of the early clients you had was McKinney when they moved into American Tobacco. So talk about that, their decision to come here and what you did.
So McKinney was actually, before McKinney also, there were two folks. It was Joe Colopi and his partner, Chaz. They started Bronto, and there were two folks started in an office here. And it's then little at a time, they started growing and growing, and it's amazing. And now then they sold their company here to NetSuite. That's Bronto. They're right above you,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah. No, above us, below us, around us.
Yeah, around you, everywhere.
Everywhere.
And then McKinney actually got American Tobacco on the map because they were in Raleigh, and they were like in multi-story building. Nobody could find each other, and they decided to move to Durham. So the question was like, why Durham? Like, who the hell goes to Durham? Sorry if I was, but who goes to Durham? The reason for them it was important is because it was a marketing company, advertising company, branding company. They were innovative. They were future thinkers, so they knew what a good place could change the environment. And it was awesome when we designed the space for them. We traveled with them to many places. We went to Chicago and saw architecture there. LA saw architecture there. And they became a partner in this, revitalization of, Durham. So McKinney was first. Then we had Bronto. We had Square One Bank. We had Burt's Bees at that, now Burt's Bees. At that point, it was Hill Building. It was a completely burned down, gutted shell. InterSouth Partners was a VC. So smaller firms and larger firms. And then restaurants started going in. We helped Saladelia move in. It was used to be, I think it was Starbucks earlier. And then we now working on Boracua Soul in the same place.
Oh, yeah.
Yes,
in that location.
Yeah.
But then again, what had been known as places like Motorco and the Pit, that was all sort of heavy, light industrial area. And again, nobody ever thought that would come alive as a night spot. But you worked on some of those buildings as well.
Yeah, we did. So I think once American Tobacco stabilized this spot, Durham, people were looking at, where else and, what's next. So Northside was, there were some beautiful buildings there. And our partner in the Pit at that point, is Greg Hiram from Empire Properties from Raleigh. So he bought the building and we worked on it together. So Pitt went in, and then across the street was Motorco. We helped design Motorco, and that was, you know, it was, that was the, you know, catalyst of all the, you know, like nightlife going on at that side.
Well, what's cool about it all is that it worked with the architecture that's here. I love what you said earlier. You know, everybody else came to Durham and said, I ain't going back there. And you said, look at this. It's a blank canvas. What I could do with this. But it wasn't about tearing it all down. It was about using the architecture that was here to develop the vibe that a company like McKinney might say, look, that's the thing that brands us, right? That's
absolutely
who we are.
Yeah. So I think that's, you know, that's our design. That's Alliance's design philosophy. That, you know, we believe in authenticity. We believe in respecting what is there. We believe in naturalness. And we believe in people, actually. And, you know, it's like the people that make, you know, spaces into really nice places, you know. So, and I think even if you see any of our projects, you know, and now we're working on Golden Belt. I don't know if I'm jumping the gun, but, you know.
Yeah, no, we'll talk about that and about all of that and the way in which it developed. But then, and we'll also talk about some of the downside, which is sometimes the people who get left behind. All of that is on the table when we come back and continue our conversation with Vandana Daik, who helped revitalize Durham one abandoned building at a time. Oh, yeah, and then there's Mount Kilimanjaro. All that. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with architect Vandana Daik today. Durham Magazine recently named her one of the top 20 women making an impact globally and locally. She's a principal of Alliance Architecture and part of the redesign and revitalization of downtown Durham. What's your favorite project? Do you have one?
There are many favorite projects, but one of the most interesting projects that I don't think anybody has on their resume is I've designed a condom testing lab. And when I tell that to people, it's like, what are you,
condo testing lab?
Yeah, so FHI 360 or Family Health International 360, they have this condom testing lab in Morrisville where actually they are donating or they're sending condoms to Africa, to Asian countries. But
can I sign up? I mean, do they need participants?
Oh, you do not want to sign up because these condoms.
How do they? Because I'm imagining how you might test them. I think maybe I would.
There are equipment. There is a sound booth, completely like tested sound booth, where they push pressure or water in the condoms and hear them pop. Condom gets. I mean, a regular condom becomes that big that it could probably fit a elephant. It's like, oops, sorry, let's move on. Sorry.
No. Well, we're stuck now. We're here. We're talking about a word. So there's the technology and obviously the need, you know, but why do we need an architect for that? Just like
so
in a room.
So it's the space planning. It's, you know, how do the whole, the sequence of events, you know, it gets tested first with air, then it gets tested with water, and then how much of seepage of water is there, if there is any. So, then there's packaging. And then while they were doing the condom testing, there's also mosquito net testing. So they were also like, you know, sending out a lot of
mosquito nets.
No,
they don't put the mosquito
Africa.
Net on the condom, do they? Let me ask you this. But here's the only other thing that I worry about there is that once you've gone through all that testing, haven't you, like, are you just testing a prototype or does each one get tested?
So no, it's not each one. So they come in boxes and then it's randomly tested from the box.
Ah, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm glad we talked about that. But there's all the stuff, and you talked about revitalizing, and obviously one of the things that people notice about Durham is the fact that we've maintained some of these historic buildings and that it has the feel of a place that has a history. And it's got, you know, a conflicted history. Part of the challenge now, and some of the critique is that, yeah, you hate to see a city crumble and die, and so revitalization is necessary because there's sort of no alternative. It's one or the other, it seems. But people are being left behind. Gentrification then becomes the kind of collateral damage. What do you feel about that? What do we do about it?
So, Frank, that's a very, very difficult question. It's a very difficult question. And John and I and a lot of our friends have always talked about it. But what is the alternate? Is the alternate to leave everything as it is? And I think collectively as a society, as Durham resident, we all need to pitch in and do something about it. It's not only the city, it's not only the county. I think it's every citizen, every person who's paying taxes in Durham needs to collectively come up with a plan. What I've seen is there are many little plans. There are many initiatives happening all around, whether it's education or housing or employment. But there just doesn't seem to be enough one cohesive thing that, you know, everybody pitches behind.
Well, we'll see. It's kind of interesting. If you think about the East Durham Children's Initiative, yep, which has had such enormous success, you can't even call it a pilot anymore in the way that they've succeeded in their little corner of the world. And I think, you know, they're about to expand that project so that education, and hopefully they'll become a prototype and a model for the rest of the country. There may be in the works a feasible plan for affordable housing.
Yep.
I have not seen them work anywhere else. There's a chance that what we're seeing being put together in Durham might be a little bit different. So there's all that to be done, but it does. And it's, you know, you don't. It's not architects who are. I mean, here I am on the board of the Durham Co-op Market, and it was one of the things that the neighborhood, people in the neighborhood at West End and Lyon Park, said, we want that corner developed, self-help, duke it together. People like me who are interested in a market put it on, and then we build it, and it's there. And now I can't help but feel some responsibility for the gentrification in that neighborhood that is pushing people out of the neighborhoods and making them feel like strangers in their own place.
So I think
it is a mixed bag. You know, you don't know how to feel about yourself.
And
right?
I think the solution should be not pushing them out, but how can we include them? If they are there, how can we include them? And what role can they be included in? And I think that's what we need to be working more on, like, what is the mechanism that they can participate in this prosperity or, you know, on the Durham Rising?
Yeah. Well, we'll talk more about that and hopefully give it more thought. I want to hear about your adventures on Mount Kilimanjaro, and you're about to do Machu Picchu. So we would think that you're kind of a real outdoors woman, but not so. How did you come to climb
Mount Kilimanjaro? Oh, my God. So, as I said, you know, I'm not at all a sports person or outdoor person at all. And, you know, I've been going to the Y. I've been a member of the Y last 15 years. And I would go to the Y twice a year, January resolution, and then maybe sometime in June. And I'm just not at all outdoor person. But then elections happened in 2016. And, you know, I had no idea how to respond to what had happened, like many of us. The next day, I met a friend, and, he just asked me, do you want to climb Kilimanjaro? And this is in 2016. And without thinking, I said yes. And that night, I had a complete panic. I said, what the hell? You know, I've never done anything like this. And how high is Kilimanjaro? And where exactly is it? I knew it was in Tanzania because I'd gone on a safari to Kenya, yeah. South Kenya, and I could see that beautiful, you know, the scenic, you know, the Kilimanjaro with the giraffe in the foreground, that picture. And so I talked to Shane and said, hey, Shane, I've never done this. And he said, well, let's go to Eno. So we go to Eno over the weekend, and he said, I think you can do it, but you need to start training. So this was December of 2016. And there was no going back after that.
Then you took it to Okanichi, and you climbed that giant.
Yes.
Well, walking on the Eno and climbing Kilimanjaro are not the same thing. So, what was the training like for you from that point on?
So it was initially. This is amazing. This whole thing was like one step at a time, one day at a time. The training started with 5 push-ups, 2 push-ups, 2 squats, 3 squats, right? And I'd never done anything. And then it slowly became, you know, every other day, 10 squats, 20 squats, 50 squats, 100 squats. And I think what really kept me going was just to keep the noise out of my brain of the politics that was happening around and to focus on a mission that I could control, you know, and that to me was really, really awesome.
So talk about the climb.
So the climb was very interesting. It was an 8-day climb. It was all in a tent. I had never tented before in my life, except for once on the North Carolina beach, which was a whole different experience. And the most interesting thing, or the most difficult thing, was how do you pee in a bottle, being a woman? And, mm-hmm. you know, I thought it would be very easy and I should have practiced, but overconfident me, I did not practice. And the first night, Frank, was a disaster. The good news was I was in the tent by myself. Mm-hmm. And there was everywhere. Thank God I had extra toilet paper. So I cleaned up and and I didn't tell anybody because I was too embarrassed. Like, how do I tell people? Like, you know, so the next day I figured out that, you know, I'm going to use they would give us a cleaning bowl. So I started using that and not tell anybody and then just throw the water out the next morning. But so that was really interesting. But to me, the climb itself was, it was hard. It was one step at a time, one day at a time. You know, and before the climb, I thought that I would figure life out. I would figure relationships out. I would figure out where I'm going to end up and all that stuff. But when you're climbing, you realize none of that is happening. All you're figuring out, all you're focusing is on your breathing. That's it. One step in and out, in and out. And also thought, I realized that how alone, but how full you are as a person. Because it's only you who matters. It's your, you know, your body, your spirits, and your, you know, your heart. And that's all that matters. Your body, I was thanking my knees and my heart every day to support me in the hike. And I would, you know, like massage them at the end of the hike. And it was a very special experience.
But it seems to me you had a kind of an epiphany, too. You thought that this would be a time when you could think about things, and the space that you would have to think about those things would give you an answer. As it turns out, you're consumed with your being, and that became the answer for you.
That is, and that's for everyone. That is the answer of the being. We just so forget about ourselves and the being because we are focusing on all these extra stuff and extra, you know, that we just forget about all that. That the most important person is first me. And to me, that was really interesting.
But the paradox, too, because you hinted at this just a minute ago, that you're not alone. So in that exquisite moment when you realize the all-consuming nature of meanness and being, right, every breath, in that same moment, you feel a connection to everything. So you're not, you are at once totally alone and with yourself and also connected to everything on Earth.
That's so rightly said, Frank, that you are so alone, you're so alone. It's the deepest of being alone. And then at the same time, you're with everything. And you're with your body, with your heart, with your spirits, and you're with the people who are walking with you one step at a time. You're with nature around you, the beautiful sky, the summit of Kilimanjaro, you know, the clouds that are above you. So it is, I can't explain. It is like one of those, it's an amazing feeling.
Again, because you had a very different expectation. Was that sort of the first time that this kind of feeling, this exquisite, let's call it an epiphany, what was that like to sense that, especially at that elevation?
It's, I can't explain. Yeah. It was beautiful. And I when I got up to the summit, I remember I was in tears because it was such a beautiful feeling that I wanted to share it with everybody I loved. So I did make a little video and I thanked everybody, all my, you know, friends and mom and dad and my trainer and everybody, because it was such a beautiful feeling. And I just wish and hope that, you know, all of us get that again, you know.
Well, you're going to do it again. You're headed to Machu Picchu, are you?
Yeah, so but last year I did Everest Base Camp, which was a whole different, you know, experience because Kilimanjaro was just one summit, so it was easy. You go up 5 days and you come down one day. Whereas Everest Base Camp, though it's a lower altitude, was very different because these are like, you know, series of mountains you're doing up and down. And what I realized was the mind plays such a trick because once I summited the base camp, my mind and body is telling me, no, I'm done. Like, you know, this is what we had signed up. This is what you had signed me up for. I'm done. Get me out of this place. But we had another 5 days to come down. And that was, to me, the hardest ever, because I'm telling my mind, like, you know, and my body, no, we got another 5 days, and they are shutting down on me. You know, they're saying, no, we're done. And the last day, actually, I was going to quit and take a helicopter down. And I was already packed and all that stuff. And I remember called John, and John said, well, you do whatever you need to do. And I called up my mom and dad and said, you know, I just can't. And then I realized, and the next morning I get up and I'm perfectly fine. And it was all about people's, you know, good wishes, blessings, whatever you say. That's when I said that you can't do this alone. You have to have people. And I've been so lucky that there have been people, you know, who have supported me. And it just, things just work out.
How about John? Is he obviously somewhat supportive? Does he participate in all this?
I think he participates, that he supports me. And it was really awesome when we went to, when I went to Kilimanjaro, he was waiting for me in Amsterdam. So, you know, we spent a few days in Amsterdam. And now actually what's really awesome is he's gotten in the rhythm of, you know, working out also.
Oh.
So, yeah. So who knows, in the future it could be. And actually he's coming to Machu Picchu, but he's going to take the train and I'll be hiking. So
all right,
well, one step at a time.
Yeah,
one step at a time.
What about what's next for you? Durham looks pretty well done. Are you moving on, or what's going to happen?
Actually, Durham looks pretty done, but we have been so lucky that clients and relationships we've built in Durham are taking us all over the world. So we have a project going on in India. We have a project going on in London, in Brighton. We are designing something in Brazil, Sao Paulo. That's Avalara, and it's right on Diamond View 1. And we did an amazing project for them in Seattle, so they keep growing. We have another project, Pendo, which is in Raleigh. We did help them design some space in Israel. So, yeah, it's been awesome.
How do you like the travel?
I love it.
Yeah.
You meet different people, different food. And I'm a hardcore vegetarian, so, you know, it's interesting. And what I found is it's so easy to get vegetarian food all around the world but U.S., but North Carolina.
Yeah.
But it's changing now.
Yeah.
It's changing.
Durham, there's like seitan-wrapped bacon. Bacon-wrapped seitan.
Yeah.
That's about as close as you get. Been back to India? Do you get back often?
Yeah, actually, this last 2 months, I've already made 2 trips. So, yeah, it's because of the project.
Because of the project. Yeah. What's it like to get back there and kind of work professionally and being now a woman of the world?
Some things are awesome. It is, I mean, the energy in India, you know, of the workers, you know, the people who are doing projects, designers, architects, amazing. People are so willing to work. It's like, you know, 24/7. What's really difficult is, you know, just the population, you know, and, you know, India is growing so fast. So it's not very planned growth.
Vandana Dake is principal at Alliance Architecture. She is my guest today. You can find out more about her work at our website, stateofthings.org. Vandana, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Namaste.
The State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Grant Hullab-Mormon. Robin Copley is our technical director. Josie Terrace is our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.